The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. If you had not heard of TikTok in 2019, chances are you've heard of it by now, either because you're a user or you have heard about the controversy surrounding TikTok from the news or both. On its website, TikTok describes itself as a destination for short-form mobile videos. It is owned by ByteDance, a Chinese multinational internet technology company headquartered in Beijing, China. At $100 billion valuation, it would be fair to consider it an internet heavyweight. TikTok has been the subject of controversy because of allegations that it has worked with the Chinese Communist Party to censor and survey content on topics deemed of interest to the party. On August 6th, the Trump administration issued executive orders targeting TikTok and WeChat, declaring that the two apps would be blocked from processing transactions for U.S. citizens and from being downloaded in U.S. app stores due to security concerns. Later in August, the administration, in a separate executive order, said that TikTok would face a complete ban if it did not sell to a U.S. company by November 14th. To avert the ban, TikTok recently announced they had reached a deal with Oracle and Walmart, creating a new independent company, TikTok Global, headquartered in the U.S. Oracle and Walmart will own 20% of TikTok Global, with respective stakes of 12.5% and 7.5%. Under the new arrangement, Oracle will host all of TikTok's U.S. user data and will safeguard TikTok's computer systems to, quote, ensure U.S. national security requirements are fully satisfied. But the TikTok controversy highlights a much larger issue, that of U.S. user data exfiltration to external nation states, such as China, as a security and privacy risk, an unintended consequence of our addiction to social and entertainment platforms is exfiltration of a treasure trove of user data for potentially nefarious uses.
Our guest today is Ann Kokas. Ms. Kokas is an associate professor of media studies at the University of Virginia and a senior faculty fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center for Public Affairs. Kokas' research broadly examines Sino-U.S. media and technology relations. Her research has been funded by the Fulbright Foundation, the Social Science Research Council, the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars, the Mellon Foundation, and the Abbe Foundation. She is a fellow with the National Endowment for the Humanities and at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, in the opening, we referred to the creation of a treasure trove of user data created by our use of, say, TikTok or other platforms. What kinds of data are we talking about, and how could exfiltration of this data be used to pose a security risk?
So the type of data that people think about immediately are the things that they themselves post. So pictures, videos, different little political commentary that you may put on your different social media accounts following a presidential debate, for example.
For example, yeah.
And that is definitely one part of it. But the kind of bigger questions are things like account information, but also metadata, like looking at how one uses a specific account, when you use something, where you use it, who you're connected to. So all of that gives a really kind of clear picture of someone's financial circumstances, how they use their time, who they go places with, where they go, and how that connects with the rest of their life. So it's really a very full profile of who we are as people.
So I'm going to ask you this question, and then I'm going to follow up after your answer with a bit of an answer myself. You have argued that TikTok is not alone and that the issue of data exfiltration extends beyond these entertainment platforms. What other companies are you thinking of?
So there are actually a lot of firms that were, first of all, one of the big issues in the US is the lack of transparency. So we don't necessarily know where most companies are storing their data, or even if we know where they're storing it, where they're processing it. So that's one kind of big issue. In terms of kind of specific areas of concern, one company that comes up a lot is DJI drones. So this is the world's largest drone manufacturer. It's a Chinese-owned company. They own 97% of the global drone market. So they're able to basically have these flying cameras going around the entire country, not just here, but elsewhere around the world. And they store their data in China. So that's a level of surveillance that's comical, particularly in comparison to anything that would be allowed in China.
Yeah, so my example, although now I have two examples, today, actually, my husband was saying that our smart thermostat had some advice for when we might want to set some away times on our thermostats. And he's saying, gee, I wonder what this is about. And I just looked at it, and my reaction was, it's telling people when they can come and rob our house. Clearly, you're not in your upstairs at this and that time. We'll come then. So you're right in that the little breadcrumb trails are kind of important. And it's kind of unusual.
Yeah, and the part that's really interesting about this is a lot of companies have incentive to datafy the lives of their consumers because it gives them more resources. So I went to this really fascinating conference where a company that shall remain nameless was talking about a smart mixer for making brownies and how this would really transform the kitchen experience. And I was like, have they never like made brownies before? I mean, you know, if you need a smart mixer for brownie preparation, there are much larger problems with your cooking skills than, you know, getting the right mixer, for example. But they would be able to monetize that data, and the consumer products like mixers wouldn't be able to do that in a previous generation.
And clearly they would sell that to, you know, health insurance, whatever. This person eats far too many brownies.
Look at these carbs.
or diet apps, right?
Oh, yeah.
You've mentioned Zoom, and you know, we're using Zoom right now as one of the other companies. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, Zoom is a really interesting company in the sense that they're ubiquitous, particularly in the pandemic era. It's
become a verb almost. Everyone's
right, exactly.
Zooming.
Yeah. Or a generation, the Zoomers.
Yes, right.
Which I don't know if they would ascribe that to themselves, but that's a whole other story. The part that's really interesting about Zoom is it wasn't necessarily preordained that they would be the company that would take over video conferencing for the pandemic. I mean, there are a lot of other services available. Facebook has a video messaging service, Microsoft owns Skype, but Zoom really just took off, I think largely because they already had an established enterprise business. Mm-hmm. One of the other things Zoom has is an engineering operations of over 3,000 people in China, which is not a problem in itself, except for the fact that they have also demonstrated that they're willing to follow Chinese local laws in order to continue that relationship and not disclose necessarily which laws were being followed. So, okay. You know, it's one thing to follow local law in order to operate in a business setting. It's another thing to make the decision to operate in China, which has some kind of serious potential political consequences for a tech firm. It's another thing entirely to not be transparent about what those legal infringements are.
What kind of local laws in China make it worrisome? You know, we talked a little bit in this episode and prior episodes about the Chinese state's use of technology and data against the ethnic, you know, Muslim minority, for example. But I mean, what kinds of laws are they that the U.S. companies, you've argued, are agreeing to abide by, but that really caused concern? And is it concern in terms of a humanitarian reason, you know, a security reason, or what?
So I would say in the context of Zoom, it has to do with both humanitarian issues and freedom of expression more than, in addition to security issues, but I would say the humanitarian issues and freedom of expression issues are the biggest concerns from my vantage point. So from a humanitarian standpoint, we have the example of on June 4th, the company shut down a conversation between Chinese activists in the United States who were former, who were protesters in Tiananmen Square and people in China. And they shut it down without saying why. And these were people who were having a conversation in the US and then afterwards said that they would shut it down in accordance with local Chinese laws, but have since declined to say which laws they shut it down for.
Interesting.
So that really kind of cuts down on the potential for dialogue within these two spaces. And the fact that this is an American company doing this, not a Chinese firm that happens to be operating in the US, I think is something that's really concerning, because they're being underwritten by US capital markets. Now, the other potential issue that I see with regard to Zoom that I'm particularly sensitive to as an educator is the fact that now a lot of classes are being taught on Zoom, and we have a large number of international students who are taking classes on Zoom. Around 300,000 international students from China and the US, many of whom are currently receiving education in China over platforms like Zoom. And they are subject to online governance laws, which could make them criminally or civilly liable for what they produce and consume online.
Wow. Even though they might be taking a class, for example, here, that the Chinese government objects to the content of that class, is what you're saying.
Right, exactly. So they could potentially face civil or criminal liability. Now, fortunately, we haven't seen a raft of that happening. Mm-hmm. The big issue is, and I would, you know, direct people back to your excellent episode on the Uyghurs and tech in China. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily know what the particular political profile or the ethnic profile is of our students. So they may be already in a vulnerable group.
Let's go back to your point about the fact that there is a lack of transparency about where data is processed, and essentially the information supply chain, if you will. Is this not exactly the sort of thing that GDPR was supposed to address, GDPR out of the UK and the EU?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it is better than nothing. Japan also has regulations for data privacy and the movement of data out of Japan. They're still rather relatively clumsy. And if you've ever been in Europe accessing a website and they, you know, give you all these like really scary warnings, you're like, I still want to read this article. I'm just clicking through. So I mean, it's not perfect, sure, by any means. But at least there are some legal mechanisms in place. The same in Japan as well. Now, one thing, so it is very difficult to regulate these things. However, we can demand a little bit more transparency from companies than things like what Oracle has done with this new TikTok global deal, which said that they will be a secure and trusted technology partner. But we have no idea what that actually means. All that they say in the press releases is that they're going to prevent anything bad from happening on a security level.
Trust us.
But at the same time, they're getting like this treasure trove of data from TikTok global. So why would they want to, you know, cut themselves off from that amazing source of information for their products?
Yeah, and with GDPR, I didn't want to. I'm actually not a fan of GDPR, mm-hmm, largely because I think that it is the case that it is more intrusive, you know, your mm-hmm example of trying to access things, than it is successful. And it has caused some sites to, you know, elect not to provide service to customers they perceive as coming from GDPR protected regions, which fundamentally is breaking the internet, but that's a different episode. but I guess it does come back to the question of, you know, there isn't even a fig leaf of legal protection against this in this country.
Yeah.
Well, fig leaf is a great way of putting it. You know, I think there are potentially three separate, I guess, issues. One is the fact that some companies may be owned by, in whole or in part, by China, right? And so the whole set of discussions on TikTok's ownership basically says, oh, you know, if it were owned by US company, then there's the issue of how the user data is, where the user data is being handled, right? So, oh no, in this deal, as you said, Oracle is saying we will handle the data and house it on our own cloud infrastructure in the US. But I guess the larger question is, you know, what about the data being used by your own government? I mean, there's an implicit assumption that anything that China is handling is bad and non-transparent, but anything our government potentially handles is good, even though we don't have transparency.
All right, so I want to push back hard on that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that US government data gathering is great, nor do I think that extensive US corporate data gathering is great. I think there should be stronger protections in this country against government intrusion and stronger protections against corporate intrusion. The one limited advantage that we have here is, provided that the democratic system continues to function, we can actually respond to these things by voting in elections and talking with our elected officials and trying to lobby them. Now, again, obviously there are a lot of flaws in this system, but we don't even have that level of accountability for data that's being moved to China. And that's what I think the big issue is here. So I think that there's definitely a place for activism within the US context for how there needs to be better protection domestically from US government data gathering as well as US corporate data gathering. And in some ways, the lack of protections are precisely what have allowed Chinese corporations to really run rampant in the US context.
And do we think that the Chinese government or the might have a similar perspective of, you know, early internet companies build up, Facebook, you know, does whatever it wants with user data. People could at one point could sign up from China. And here they are with all this Chinese citizen data being stored and manipulated and used outside of the reach of Chinese law. I mean, it seems like it would be a fair counter argument.
Right. And they have made that argument and have banned any kind of major US platforms. So, I mean, the Chinese government is putting their money where their mouth is as it relates to the potential risks from foreign companies and gathering Chinese data. There's a reason why Netflix can't enter as a platform, but they can license their content. And it's because of the type of data that they're able to gather.
Can you talk a little bit about the intelligence value? I mean, there's definitely the issue of privacy or monetization of this data, but what is the intelligence value of user data, let's say from TikTok, to the Chinese government?
So first of all, I want to be really clear that it's not like there's a clear line directly from ByteDance to the Chinese government. There are a couple of places where there has to be like an official national security review, et cetera. So it's not like ByteDance is like directly funneling data to the Chinese government. So there are these distinctions, and depending on the power of any individual Chinese company, there may be more or less ability to push back. So I think that's important to note. But there is a mechanism, a national security review mechanism for the Chinese government to access any data that's domiciled in China. So that's also important to note. That data can be used to produce profiles of individuals. So, you know, for human intelligence gathering, it can be used to produce profiles of communities or of whole nations. And we have an election coming up in the US. So for the purposes of an effective dis or misinformation campaign, being able to profile and understand how an entire nation or blocks of communities function becomes very, very important. And then there are things like the development of advanced technologies like AI that provide, that are able to advance much more quickly when you have a large user data, and specifically a large multi-ethnic user data set. So this has been an issue for China in the development of domestic platforms. There are a lot of people, but there aren't a lot of different types of people. So in order to develop really effective AI systems, you need to be able to model people from lots of different contexts. Right. So that's why TikTok is so valuable, and why under the National Security Review, China has not allowed the algorithm for TikTok to be sold only the data to be moved to a different place.
Wow. It kind of reminds me of shades of, Cambridge Analytica, in a sense, of just profiling en masse, right? And then being able to identify potential vulnerabilities to manipulate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that TikTok, if we think about Cambridge Analytica, TikTok would be the kind of Chinese option for something like that.
Mm-hmm. And it even takes us back to Edward Snowden and the revelations of what the US government really was doing with, you know, in that case, it was specifically metadata. Who is talking to whom turns out to be really useful information to somebody.
Yeah. And I mean, this is not to say just because the Chinese government and Chinese corporations are gathering lots of data and processing it is not to say that that is not still happening within the US government. And actually it's really funny, when I was in 2013, when all the Snowden revelations came out, I was a research fellow at the Shanghai Institute of International Studies, which is a policy research institute in Shanghai. And every day we would have lunch together, me and the other policy guys who had been in government at different times, and we'd watch the news and we'd talk about it. And the Snowden revelations came out, and I was like, oh my God, can you imagine this level of US government data gathering? And they were just like, come on, man, you Americans can't be this naive about your own country.
So that was ordinary everyday type of thing, right?
Yeah, one of the guys, he was so funny, he was like, I mean, the fact that's surprising for us is that you're surprised.
Oh my gosh. So sort of a naivete of the Americans. I want to read you something that you wrote in an article published in Washington Post just this August. You said, large numbers of firms serving US consumers, whether they're physically based in China or in the US, are under pressure by the Chinese government to exfiltrate data. Combined with data gathered through hacks of Equifax, Marriott, Anthem, and the Office of Personnel Management, the Chinese government has a treasure trove of information to support intelligence gathering activities for decades to come, regardless of last week's bans. I assume you were talking about TikTok. Without comprehensive data security regulation, the executive orders are merely window dressing. What kind of security data security regulation do you think we need, and why hasn't it been done already?
Well, there's a lot of money involved in not having any oversight over how data is processed and can be processed in this country. It's a product and it's a resource. So any constraints are limiting how that resource can be used for product development. And we have a system in the US which allows for extensive lobbying by wealthy firms, and tech firms are some of the wealthiest firms in the country. So that's part of why. The other reason is it's a very arcane topic in a lot of ways, though all of us are online all the time. We don't necessarily think about the back end or, you know, the security issues. Essentially, it only becomes an issue when, you know, we lose our password, or, you know, there's a hack and we can't get on, or there's some sort of a disruption. But most people don't like to think about it all the time. So if you think about the things that people actually really actively lobby their representatives for, data security regulation is not always on the top of the list. In fact, it's pretty far down. That's one of the reasons why I think it's important to do research on this, because I think it's a really important thing for people to understand how their data is being gathered and what's being done with it, not just here, but abroad.
So, and I think we're trying to do our part to, you know, highlight this and bring it to people's minds, but what would you suggest the average person should be thinking of doing about this at this point? I mean, you know, other than exercising democratic rights and, you know, voting for representatives who can actually claim to do something about it.
Yeah.
What are the practical solutions either, you know, that we should be looking for from government or enacting ourselves?
Yeah. So a couple of things, just on a very basic level, pay attention to the platforms that you're using. There are different levels of security. Version Jitsi, which has slightly better security protocols than Zoom might have. So that's one option. Something else to look into is, how are you using these tools? Are you using them when you need to, or are you using them just kind of with like wanton abandon? We don't need to be surveilled at all times. So for example, do you need to have all of your devices in your bedroom while you're sleeping? Maybe not, but a lot of people do. So there are certain ways that, do you need to have a connected mixer? Do you need to have a connected home for everything? I mean, my sister got a connected wall clock and she was like, it's so great. The wall clock will tell you exactly what time it is. I was like, is it so onerous to just look at the clock? But that's not, like, there are some of these levels of absurdity where we don't necessarily need to share all of our data all of the time. So I would just urge people to be, you know, critical and self-reflective in that sense. And then also, I think it's important to look at what your state and local government can do. So our representatives in Congress, there are some people who are really doing great work on this, like Mark Warner in Virginia is really kind of making a lot of moves to enhance data security regulations. But the California Consumer Privacy Act or the New York Financial or New York's Financial Services Privacy Act are really very powerful tools, at least within a US context. So that's something that we can look at. And even individual cities can enact regulations that fund municipal data security. So there are ways that we can deal with this on a non-federal level, which might be important in the current political context.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we keep at almost at every episode sort of hammering about is, you know, what we trade off. In everything, there's a trade-off, right? For convenience, for entertainment. And sometimes we do it without thought because that little dopamine hit is so good that we don't necessarily think what we're actually trading off for it. And a lot of times what we're trading off is valuable information about ourselves and about our habits, our likes and dislikes that could be used without our knowledge, maybe for our benefit, maybe not. But the tough part of it is that a lot of times it's used without our knowledge.
And it's, yeah, and it's really obscure, right? I mean, my example of the thermostats, right? It's our upstairs thermostat has observed that on three evenings of the week, there's nobody moving. I guess that's true. I never stopped to think about it.
So now were you guys out of town during that time or?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, so we have five zones of heating, so five different thermostats. So it's just telling us that upstairs is quiet in the evening hours. So it's not, I'm not particularly wigged out about it because it's like, yeah, well, it's not the only thermostat in the house. And we, you know, if nothing else, I'll just like tie little flares to the cat's tails and send them out to to make some movement. But the point stands, you know, this is the sort of thing that you just don't notice, right? You don't notice which times of day you're typically, I don't know, in the basement theater room and not paying attention to the rest of the house. And somebody who was casing your place would. And now we have invited all these devices into our homes to case the place.
Yeah. And something else that I find to be really interesting is we don't necessarily know what happens when data is sold. So a great example of this is the case of Axon, which it was formerly Taser. And they're a big maker of body cameras. Now, one thing that I did not know before I started doing this research is that that footage is owned by the company. And police departments have access to it as long as they pay for subscriptions.
Wow, so the footage that the police from their body camera takes, that is not owned by them. And if they're not paying, they can never recoup it, even though it could come up. I mean, those are the only evidence sometimes people have of, you know, police, over aggression.
Well, yeah, so let alone what else they might want to do with that.
Yeah. Right. Well, and then what happens when just the company went, like if a police department stops paying Axon, then what do they do with all that footage?
Right. Yeah.
It's monetizable in a really dark way.
Yeah. Certainly it can be used as compromise, right? If the person who in the video is somebody of note, of renown.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, that's one of definitely one of the darker intersections of, you know, corporatized policing and data security regulations.
What do you say to these companies, who U.S. companies, who want to compete in China? And they're really disadvantaged, right? And the Chinese government is insisting that they, in order for them to, you know, have at it at the Chinese market, they need to abide by these regulations. It's either, you know, you abide 100% or you don't, and you're out. A lot of times these companies are actually justifying it based on, this is what I need to be able to compete and survive.
Yeah, and that might be true, actually. I mean, there is a business case for making these trade-offs, at least in the short term. In the long term, the business case starts to evaporate because most of the time, the types of joint venture deals that tech companies in particular have to enter into in order to participate in the Chinese market are disadvantageous in the sense that they help to prepare their competitors. Mm-hmm. So you might get, you know, some quarterly profits, or you might be in the situation of, for example, U.S. automotive companies right now, which are very dependent on the China market. It's the biggest automotive market in the world, but are now caught in the middle of a trade war. So there's a lot of potential volatility.
Good point.
So where do we go from here?
Man, that is the question I ask myself every day as I get on Zoom in the morning to practice yoga. Like, oh God. I don't know. I mean, I think I am trying to advocate for increased awareness of these issues, increased advocacy at state, local, and national levels. And I think that it's also really important for platforms like yours to make people aware of the consequences of the choices that they're making, because frankly, no company in their right mind would do that for consumers. They have too much money to lose.
And that's not really a new position for companies. I mean, I'm still struck by, you know, in the early days, in the late 1800s, when the food production was just being sort of industrialized, and there was no, you know, FDA, there was no regulation anywhere in the world. The stories of what they used to put into cocoa powder in order to try to make it, you know, look good, let alone taste good. I mean, grinding up cocoa beans with brick dust, you know, and who was going to stop them? So I think we're maybe sort of kind of at the grinding up our internet data with brick dust and then trying to drink it phase. So
yeah, no, beyond. 1,000%. I mean, and we can look at other debates like lead paint usage, cigarettes. Mm-hmm. There's a very long and storied history of placing profits over consumer health and safety. And I think that we're just at the next moment of that.
So we've seen this thing before. It's just in a different format, is what you're saying.
Sadly, yes. Mm. But on the plus side, so many good cat videos, guys. So many great dance challenges.
Indeed.
Yes, as Alexa said, there are trade-offs. Yeah. Well, it's been a great chat. We've really enjoyed having you. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you so much. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.